Welcome to the INSS English podcast series, where you can listen to researchers discuss their findings and hear about research in progress. The INSS podcast addresses a range of current developments which carry implications for Israel's national security, whether in the international and regional spheres or in the local Israeli arena. I'm Sarah Foyer. I'm a research fellow at the INSS, and I'm here with Orit Perlov, also a research fellow. We thought today that as we approach the 8th anniversary of the outbreak of the uprisings, which shook the region in what later came to be known as the Arab Spring, we thought it was an opportune moment to pause, look around the neighborhood, and take stock. So
be a little bit pessimistic.
Be a little pessimistic because it is the Middle East, yeah, after all.
Exactly. So
we're going to be asking a few questions. First of all, what's left of those uprisings? Where might the region be headed? And what are some implications for Israel out of all of this? So, Orit, to take up the first question, what has become of this post-spring landscape? I guess we could answer it in a few different ways. One would be through the lens of specific countries and trajectories and where they've gone. So let's look at Egypt for a moment.
We started with countries that we'll head there. I would say maybe the most pessimistic one, because when Jan 25th and April 6th launched in Egypt, I think it was the most optimistic, I guess, arena. I'm coming from the social media discord field, in which we heard a lot of voices, I guess. It was the most vivid and passionate discussions that we can find over social media and activity in order to change the reality, political reality, social, economic reality, and so on. And 8 years after, there's not much left, I would say. I guess if I need to summarize it best through an activist on social media, it would be, if you are young today and you're an activist in the Middle East, you have only four, I guess your options can minimize to four. It's either you choose exile, I guess you're becoming a refugee and you're looking, you're going abroad. Mm-hmm. If you're like, if you have, if you're part of the elite or the middle class that was, you know, I mean, was the one, I mean, the base for the Arab Spring and so on. Today, you can find yourself outside, I guess, abroad. Then we have jail, unfortunately. And if we're talking about Egypt, around, I would say, between 60,000 and 70,000 political activists, and whether they belong to the Muslim Brotherhood or secularist, both find themselves in jail for voicing their opinion and so on and their activity. Then we have silence, people who are afraid to be killed or jailed, and then they still want to stay in Egypt because of their families and so, and jobs. So they chose silence, closed their Facebook pages, Twitter pages, and so on. And the last part, maybe the most pessimistic one, is depression. 8 years post the Arab Spring, and almost there, you can not only that you don't see anything, any reforms in Egypt, but the opposite. Everything went back almost to level one, more oppression, and more depression, as I said, that you can find in Egypt.
So, how do you see Tunisia? That rather negative note, well, before turning to Tunisia, because we want to maybe end on a slightly more positive note, it is worth mentioning what's been happening in Libya, which is also a slightly more negative picture. I mean, ironically, though, in Libya, I think there was a feeling at the outset that the country had a couple of things going for it. First of all, there was this notion that the absence of state institutions actually might have been a good thing for Libya, because it could have sort of started from scratch. We had experiences in Iraq and elsewhere where dismantling prior existing institutions had led to negative consequences. So in Libya, there was a feeling, okay, maybe it's actually a positive thing. And the fact that they had oil, and this was presumably going to be an economy that could stand on its own and not fall apart. In a way, those two things have, ironically, I think, become sources of a lot of the conflict and the stalemate and really the fight at this point over resources and control for the resources in Libya. So you have competing and competing governments, competing claims to legitimacy, a proliferation of militias, a country that is just awash in weapons, and all of which makes a recipe for a kind of, in a maybe perverse way, a sort of stable chaos in Libya these last so many years. But you mentioned Tunisia. This was, of course, where everything started. And in a way, today remains kind of the most optimistic case. Yeah.
Even in the Arab eyes, I have to say, when you ask, you talk to activists outside of Tunisia, they still see Tunisia.
They still looked at Tunisia as...
And they said it's more progressive, or there is still hope.
Right.
Let's say there the candle didn't die.
Right. I think certainly on the political front in Tunisia, the country has come a long way. I mean, you have a functioning parliament, broadly mm-hmm. representative. You have the beginnings of no bloodshed. Yeah. I mean, relatively very low levels of violence. You've had several rounds now of free and fair elections.
Even terrorism,
mm-hmm.
it was contained quite good.
I mean,
there is, but compared to the other Arab states that we see in post-Arab Spring, very few.
Right. And I think they got a handle on their security situation. There had been those few years at first where there were attacks and it was looking much more precarious. But since then, they've gotten a handle on it. The negative story in Tunisia is really on the economic front, I think. So they're still waiting out this IMF loan from 2016. And in exchange for the loan, as in many instances, the government has had to implement some rather unpopular austerity measures, and this is causing a lot of unrest. So it's, I think, still the fate of this Tunisian experiment is to be determined. But as you said, there are definitely positive, just for example, to take something that happened in the last month, the government published the budget of the Tunisian military.
Yeah, as part of kind of Transparency Act. So it's important because it's first in the Middle East, mm-hmm. within the Arab states.
Mm-hmm. Not something you see, exactly. Not something you see typically in the region. So, okay, so much for looking at some of the states themselves.
I can even add one more thing.
Sure.
And we saw the visit of MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, in mm-hmm. Tunisia, the crown prince of Saudi. It's the only state in the Middle East, Arab state, that had opposition to the visit. And the government let the people go outside, demonstrate, put the banners on, and so on. Never happened. If we're talking about their neighbor, I mean, Egypt.
Right.
Silence.
Zero public reaction.
Public reaction on that one. So they're allowing the public to tunnel their frustration, their anger, and so on, without any measure. Government measure, which is again, everything is comparative in the Middle East.
Right, but it's certainly a positive step.
Yeah.
Let's take up this question of the post-spring landscape from the standpoint of some of the issues that we've seen emerge, rather than
going to the topics from the states,
rather than looking at states. So talk a little bit about you've looked at the status of women in the last few years around the region. What are some things you might highlight here?
Yeah, so as you said, I guess when listening to conversation, I kind of track three main topics that I think we can see some involvement around them. Mm-hmm. One is, as you said, women, and I'll say about something about it. I will also, after that, maybe add something about the Sunnis in the Middle East and their status. Mm-hmm. And then maybe we'll say one thing about the political elite in the Middle East. So regarding women, maybe it's one of the positive. I said we're going to show only pessimistic trends, mm-hmm. but maybe to begin with, women is something optimistic, not because it's a wide phenomenon, but we can see in every election that's taking place in those states, we see the understanding that more women needs to be included in the government. More women are becoming mayor of big cities, and mm-hmm. two of them are Tunisia and Baghdad, which is impressive. Also, I can say the movement of women to drive in Saudi. So yes, the activists are in jail, being even tortured and stuff like mm-hmm. that. But it's the first time that the women are getting a wheel mm-hmm. in Saudi. We can laugh about it and be cynical, but it's not a small thing in Saudi. Yes, the guardianship law is not passed, which means they cannot drive alone, or they still need to get permission. And another thing, more women can now be chosen to the municipality election, also sports stadiums, so in cultural events and so on, they can participate with men. Mm-hmm. In the past, there was completely separation. Mm-hmm. the movement against harassment in Egypt's taking waves, and a lot of women are putting videos, are having the courage to expose harassment cases in Egypt. Mm-hmm. Some of them, unfortunately, being jailed for that. Right. Not the harasser, but the girl who was harassed, because the system is still problematic.
Right.
But we hear more women have the courage to go forward and put it on and have viral campaign and stuff like that, which is very much impressive. And I would even add, if you're talking about Gaza and the Palestinian, even in the West Bank, more women activists than men.
Interesting.
All of the campaign, the viral campaign online, made by women.
Interesting.
So, just
when I think about a place like Tunisia, which actually, from the standpoint of the role of women in public and the general status of women, had been more advanced relative to many of the states in the region. But even in Tunisia, you've seen some recent efforts. For example, there was a law criminalizing violence against women, even domestic violence, mm-hmm. that was passed. You now have big debates around this proposal out of the presidency to equalize the inheritance law in Tunisia, to bring it, give Tunisians the option essentially to opt out of following the more traditional Islamic law, mm-hmm. when it comes to this. Now, this is a big debate in Tunisia, but I think you know, the very fact that that it's being discussed is a sign of progress. And you mentioned also the fact that the mayor of Tunis is now a woman. Yeah. Let's turn to the second issue that you noted, the question of the Sunnis in the region. So what are some developments here you think might
be worth highlighting? So here is the pessimistic thing. Mm-hmm. I would say in all the election, whether it's in Iraq that we saw in May 2018 and in Lebanon, one thing is very much evident. The Sunnis are losing votes in the elections. Their parties are eradicating, because I don't know, they are very much corrupt. In the past, they had much more power in the political arena. Mm. They were I guess out of corruption and so on, the voters losing their completely hope that something will change within the political sphere, and therefore they're going and either not voting. Mm-hmm. The Sunnis are not voting compared to the Shias and so on, and that's why their parties are getting smaller. Mm-hmm. And the one who do, sometimes they vote to non-Sunnis candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they think maybe their platform are more better than the Sunnis platform, I get political platform, and that's why we saw them how they lost a lot of votes and seats in the parliament. Mm-hmm. In Lebanon and in Iraq is very much evident, which is as a trend is not good, because the Sunnis are the majority within the Arab in the Arab Middle East, and their political power is eroding. And usually in the past, when there's no political representation of the majority, then you find radicalism is coming in. And that's what we saw in Iraq with the face of Al-Qaeda and then ISIS and so on. When they feel that somebody is taking their power out of them, they found other ways
to
violence.
Means. Right.
Yeah.
Let's maybe address this question of elections and more broadly kind of what the status of the political elite is across the region. I mean, I think you've had the situation where even in cases of relative progress like Tunisia, there is a generational question here still of an older guard political elite that is still in
the
picture.
Older guard 70 plus.
Right.
The age of 70 plus.
Right.
And the majority of the Middle East population is almost 70% today is under the age of 30.
Right.
Very, very young. I think it was the president of Iraq who said just now in Europe that 50% of the Iraqi population is under the age of 19. And he said, if you won't find them job, they will find you.
Right.
I think it was a very strong message that he sent out. But yeah, so we have the gap, generational gap between the leadership and the people.
Yeah, you have places like Algeria, for example, I'm thinking of where the president who has not even really been functioning.
Exactly.
And we don't know what's going to happen there with the succession crisis, whether it could possibly lead to some kind of implosion there, which which would be highly destabilizing. But we'll come back to this question of stability in a moment. Yeah. And even in Tunisia, you know, there are examples of sort of holdovers from the old guard. Speaker of the Parliament has a very different idea of what the function and the purpose of a parliament should be. So you do find still sort of obstacles
to political elite,
to momentum.
I guess. One thing that is very much evident, because the political elite didn't change so much. Even if one had or two had left, the political elite is the same. And they understand that if no matter whether it's a democracy or not, if it's the same political elite, it will give birth to the same rotten apples. Mm-hmm. And that's why one thing was very much evident, no matter if they had a democratic election, what we saw in Tunisia, what we saw even in Lebanon, mm-hmm. and even in Iraq, the people, the turnout of the voters was less than 40%.
Dropping, right.
It's dropping dramatically.
Right.
The capitals, Beirut, Tunisia, Baghdad, less than 35% even.
Right.
So the young generation mistrust of the system is still huge.
It's pretty high.
Yeah. Very, very high.
And I think
no matter
also
what the process is, whether it's democracy or not.
Right. Because
don't
even
like
in
the
cases,
outcome.
Even in cases where you do have progress politically, there's a question of unmet expectations. And when expectations get too high and people see that, well, democracy may not translate into immediate economic gain, for example, that can also lead to some disillusionment.
Yeah.
You know, there's one other issue that I want to mention here, and that has to do with political Islam, because I think, you know, initially when the uprising started, there was this sense, okay, wait a second, maybe this is going to become a moment for Islamist movements.
The solution.
Right, exactly. The brotherhood in places like Egypt and elsewhere had their opportunity now after years of trying to various degrees.
Erdogan is a backer in Turkey. So,
right. So what now today? How can we assess the state of political Islam?
If you would ask me in 2013-14, I would tell you rest in peace. Completely dead. After the coup in Egypt and putting them all in jail and the leadership and the executions and, you know, cutting ties. And then we had in 2015, the crown prince in Saudi who said that he's gonna, if Sisi in Egypt said, in my time, there will be no Muslim Brotherhood. Mohammed bin Salman came and said, I'm going to fight two heads. One, the Sunni extremism, and the other one is the Shia extremism. So it seems like they're completely on their, you know, on their legs. I never believe in collapsing and ending and so on. I think it's evolution and a process.
Right.
They are at the weakest point, I would say. But
certainly
they're
organizationally,
still, right. Yeah, exactly. And leadership in very deep crisis, and there is a huge divide within the Muslim Brotherhood. Even we saw it in Jordan, we see it in Egypt,
sure.
Even in Turkey. But it's not dead.
Right.
We have to say it. I mean, we have Turkey, even though it's not Arab,
mm-hmm.
but the backer, the sponsor, and we know even Qatar, which is a smaller mm-hmm. entity, and Emirates, they're still backing it. They sponsor it. They're giving their land geographically, their territory, to feed it, to give it, you know, the political appearance from their news outlets and so on.
Right.
They work from there, their heads. So dead, no.
Right.
Weak, I would say yes.
Sure.
But
maybe
we'll see.
Down but not out might
exactly.
be a prognosis.
Yeah.
And
they need to trans. If you ask me, if they want to leave and they want to have some evolution, they need to reform
mm-hmm.
the movement. Maybe stay on the religious, ideological leg, but leave the political aspect maybe to other. At that point, I
right.
would say, if they want to survive and not becoming the focus of the, you know, the secular dictators' kind of battlefield
target,
and so
right.
on. Yeah, target.
In that vein, I think you are seeing some interesting sort of experimentation with Islamist brotherhood derivative groups across North Africa that are trying these, you know, leaving political activity in favor of just focusing on their religious involvement.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say watch this space, because as you said, I think
vacuum.
Political
yep.
Islam is going to still be with us for some time
Absolutely.
To come. Okay, so what does all of this mean, or what might some of mm-hmm. this mean for Israel? And here I want to pose you mm-hmm. a question like this.
Yeah.
Suppose that the states that we've talked about today were to, setting aside Tunisia possibly as an exception here, but most of the states, let's say tomorrow, they really fully opened up, liberalized.
Ethiopian scenario, yeah.
Right. What might that mean for Israel in terms of security, in terms of engagement, new opportunities, maybe challenges? What, I mean, as a net, it would be a net gain or not for Israel?
I will say that, and I'll start with a positive aspect, then move a little bit to something more pessimistic. We have advantage technology-wise, intelligence-wise, and security-wise. The Arab
Israel. Yeah.
And the Arab states need these technologies, intelligence, and security. And they absolutely 100% agree to trade with us. Money for knowledge and so on. Mm-hmm. Those three fields, you see openness. You see what we're calling in Arabic the iftitah, like the openness for this completely. And even the population, they say, completely agree. They understand that there's like political, realpolitik. Mm-hmm. You know, there's interest. We need their knowledge, whether it's security, technology, and intelligence. We have the money or the need for that, whether it's in Sinai, against Iran, no matter what. And we agree to buy it and coordinate and cooperate on this one. This is on state level.
Right.
Now, we're going a little bit further down. Population-wise, I would say that the intellectuals still in the Arab world hates us.
Right.
And they do connect and linkage the Palestinian issue with any normalization of relations with Israel.
Right.
This didn't change at all. Right. The opposite. They're frustrated when they see the government going ahead with cooperation while no move forward with the Palestinian issue. Okay? So that's the intellectual. The common people on the street and so on, I would divide it into two. Indifference, they don't care. They don't care. Most of them, there is a lot of economical burden at the moment. Most of them still focusing on domestic issues and internal illnesses. They don't care what's happening outside of their countries and so on.
Right.
Between the three non-Arab states, Israel, Turkey, and Iran, I would say they focus in on Turkey. Mm-hmm. Then Iran and Israel coming in third.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part still hates us. Mm. So I would say it's moving between indifference, completely indifference, which means that we don't care. And still there's the common ground is we don't mind to engage with Israelis on social media. I think since I would say I'm on social media 8 years, it's the first time that as an Israeli living in Tel Aviv, through social media, I can talk to people in Baghdad, Cairo, Gaza, West Bank, and even Damascus.
Mm-hmm.
So engagement, conversation, absolutely yes. But as Israel, you'll see, as you know, not on a personal level, on a state level, you see a lot of criticism regarding Israel policy. They say we are like a one state, you know, a one pony state, that we know only violence, and we don't know to do anything else. When we track, you know, that's what we know to act.
Right. You know, I think you hit on one thing that I just want to note before we wrap up, which would be that this idea that, you know, a lot people across the region today are mostly preoccupied with the problems at home. They're looking inward. And that has meant that we're in this period now where you don't really have a kind of overarching ism or ideological.
No one will run to the embassies or uprising against the embassies.
Now, you know, for a long time, we have gotten used to saying that in the Middle East, when you have an absence of power, that's never a good thing. Vacuums are not good in the Middle East because they tend to be filled by
by
bad guys. But on this point of, you know, I just would maybe suggest that actually, the absence of a kind of overarching, unifying, certainly political ideology for the region may actually turn out to be a good thing for Israel, and present some opportunities for, again, engagement. It's important to be realistic about expectations, but engagement, if not full-scale normalization.
But at least hate is a little bit is watered down,
reduced, or dampened somewhat. Okay, well, this concludes our podcast conversation for today. You're welcome to listen to all our podcasts by going to the INSS website at www.inss.org.il, where you'll find a featured section for our podcasts. You are also invited to sign up for our newsletter and receive alerts for the Institute's various research programs. Thanks for listening and take care.
Thank you.